Action. Starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball, an innocent victim of blind justice, falsely convicted for the murder of his wife. Reprieved by fate when a train wreck freed him en route to the death house. Freed him to hide in lonely desperation, to change his identity, to toil at many jobs. Freed him to search for a one-armed man he saw leave the scene of the crime. Freed him to run before the relentless pursuit of the police lieutenant obsessed with his capture.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the May 2nd edition of Talking Fugitive with Kitty and Bobby Neer. I better not spend too much more time. The intro took up a fair portion of the show. If you would like to discuss the fugitive with the aforementioned co-moderators of the Yahoo discussion group, The Fugitive Views and Reviews, you can give us a phone call, 800-407-KSAV, or you can email during the program only, talk@ksav.org. Any other time, you can reach the hosts by emailing fugitive@ksav.org. And now on with the show, Kitty and Bobby. Hi.
Hi. Good night, hon.
Good.
It's me tonight.
All right, you go ahead.
Okay. It's interesting that in that opening of the show that everybody's so familiar with, the narrator, William Conrad, says that Richard Kimball is an innocent victim of blind justice. Because the way I see it, Richard Kimball is an innocent victim of no justice whatsoever. And that's what we're here to discuss tonight. A couple of weeks ago, we did part one of the Girl from Little Egypt episode number 14 of the first season, which is a story in itself, but more important than that, it contains several flashback scenes regarding Richard Kimball, how he came to escape and come to his current predicament. And what we talked about previously was the train wreck, how he got away, how he managed to survive, and the night of the crime, what he saw when he saw the one-armed man run out in front of his car. Oh, that was very interesting. There were more, it brought up a lot of unanswered questions, but, you know, that's nothing new for this series. It does that a lot. That's all well and good, and a little bit later, about halfway through that episode, we get something that I think is really more important than anything, and that is Richard Kimball's trial. How did he come to be convicted for this crime? In my mind, how does a presumably well-respected doctor in a small town, whose father was a doctor, comes from a good family, ends up convicted of a capital crime, and ends up in this situation? Seems a little odd to me. And so we get a trial flashback that lasts all of a spectacular 3 minutes. I timed it earlier today, and it simply runs 3 minutes. And we get a couple of scenes in there to try to tell us exactly what happened at the trial. And it starts out right away. We see, first of all, the way we get into the flashback is that Kimball is driving Ruth Norton, the girl from Little Egypt, home from the airport because she's a flight attendant. And she starts asking him about his past, and he is kind of surprised that she knows almost nothing about it. And he tells her that it was a famous case and that it was in all the papers. And he says to her, I hear that somebody's writing a book about it. So I can only assume that was Ed Robertson, who probably started writing the book back in 1963. And it took him a long time. Who else could it be?
Yeah. Well, I hope he didn't charge by the hour.
I'm telling you, it took a long time to put it together. And it is very thorough, by the way. So they're talking about that, and then we get a flashback scene to the trial. First thing we see when the trial begins is something that really shakes me up, and that's Richard Kimball on the witness stand. And what is Richard Kimball doing on the witness stand? I have no idea. Because as anybody who knows anything about trials at all or ever has watched TV knows that lawyers are absolutely opposed to defendants getting on the stand. There's really no purpose to it. It gains nothing. It almost always gets them in trouble. And when you are a defendant and you get on the witness stand, you open up a Pandora's box of problems because the prosecutor is going to start asking all kinds of questions that he can't ask of anybody else. So right away, I'm just shocked. I have no idea what he's doing there. And the first thing he says, he admits on the witness stand, he says, we argued often. Bad news right away. Your wife has been murdered. you're the prime suspect, and you really want to tell the whole world that you were arguing with her all the time? I don't think so. So that only runs a few seconds, and then we go from there, we see a witness, well, sort of a long-distance witness, a woman on the stand who was a next-door neighbor, and the prosecutor asked her whether or not she had ever heard anything. She says, yes, they were next door. She and her husband heard arguing. Then he asked her whether or not she has any proof that it was violent. And she offers up as proof as the fact that one day she saw Helen Kimball with a bruise on her cheek, which I suppose is supposed to mean that that means that Richard Kimball hit her. That's not proof of anything. I mean, so what? So she saw the woman with a bruise on her cheek. I don't. That to me means nothing. That's just speculation. And Kimball is sitting at the defendant's table with his lawyer, and the lawyer does absolutely nothing. Everybody sits there. Nobody says anything. Kimball makes faces. And this is just the beginning of trouble here. She says that, and then we go right from her, that only lasts a few seconds, back to Kimball on the witness stand again, being talked to, being grilled by the prosecutor. We never see the defense attorney at all do anything, just see the prosecutor. And he presents this to him and asks her how it is she came to have this bruise on her cheek. Kimball says that she was intoxicated and she fell against the bureau. And the prosecutor says, and what did, were you there, and what did you do? Kimball says that he picked her up and treated her, and the prosecutor says, in the most sarcastic manner imaginable, and you realized how much you loved her. And he turns around and he looks at the jury, makes a face, rolls his eyes, which he does every time he asks a question. And what is the jury doing? It's just amazing. The jury is discussing the case in the jury box before the trial is over, which nobody is allowed to do. Can anybody spell mistrial? Apparently not, because nobody questions at all. Twice in these flashbacks, the jury does this. One time, the judge bangs his gavel as if to tell them to stop doing it. The other time, he does absolutely nothing. Defense attorney says nothing. So at the end of this scene, after Kimball has told how she got a bruise, he says he gets angry, and he says the prosecutor turns away. He turns around and he says, I did love her. I never stopped loving her. Another bad idea, because he's now Kimball's there proving that he loved his wife. I don't know what that's all about. He's not on trial for not loving his wife. This is not what this is all about. I don't care whether he hated her. That doesn't mean he killed her. It means absolutely nothing. We go from there, and they bring Gerard to the stand in one of the funniest moments of the entire series, which we discussed at length when we reviewed this a couple of years ago on our message board. The prosecutor asked him what he did right after the crime, and Gerard says that he personally interviewed, within 10 days after the crime, 83 one-armed men who could not possibly have been in the area the night of the crime. Well, where did he find 83 one-armed men? And I'd like to present to you, it's not just 83 one-armed men, it's 83 men with their right arm missing, not with just an arm missing, with their right arm missing, because that's Kimball's description. What do you mean they couldn't be in the area? Where was he looking? In San Francisco? I don't quite understand. Was he looking in Stafford, Indiana? And how do you find 83 one-armed men? Is there some sort of a list of them, like there is with child molesters? Do they have to register with the state when they move into the neighborhood?
I think they have an amputee hospital there in Stafford.
Well, you mean all veterans go to Stafford? That is amazing.
Yeah.
So he does that, and then the prosecutor says to him, well, you're a genius police detective, and so that certainly, you came to the conclusion that there must not be a one-armed man. At that point, thank goodness, Kimball's lawyer jumps up and objects, and the judge warns the prosecutor not to go that far. Once again, the jurors are all sitting in the jury box talking to each other. And we go from there to the judge pronouncing sentence. Kimball says, I swear by God that I did not kill my wife. And that is the end of the trial. It runs three gloriously ridiculous minutes. And I say, not only is this trial ridiculous, not only are there plenty of reasons for a mistrial, appeals, who knows what, but there's no case against Richard Kimball. What is the case against Richard Kimball? Where is the evidence? Where's the motive? Where is anything? I don't see it. Kitty, is it just me, or is there trouble here?
No, not at all. I mean, I've often thought that as well. I mean, because in this trial, I mean, so far, everything in the series, the best that they've been able to put forth as a motive for why Richard Kimble killed his wife is because his wife didn't want to adopt a baby. I mean, it's like, okay, she's a selfish person. She doesn't want to adopt a baby, but how many men would actually kill their wives because they don't want to adopt a baby? I mean, it's just kind of absurd. There's no mention that he's maybe got a great big life insurance policy on her so that he's got monetary gain by getting rid of her. There's no hint that he's got a lady friend on the side. I mean, there's just nothing. He has, what does he have to gain by murdering his wife? I mean, it's other than the fact he can marry somebody else and have a kid. I mean, it's kind of absurd when you think about it. And moreover, just the way he's convicted of a capital crime and sentenced to die, at this point in the series, we're not really sure how she was killed. I mean, at this point in the series, the way that you see her on the floor with the lamp, it's implied that he hit her over the head with a lamp. So you would think he would be found guilty of manslaughter. It's in later episodes where all of a sudden they've decided that Kimble strangled his wife, and I guess maybe somebody said, well, gosh, you know, maybe we need to make it out that she was strangled so that there is premeditation involved here. But it was my impression in Girl from Little Egypt, the implication was that she was hit over the head with a lamp.
Well, the lamp is there on the floor, is it not?
Exactly.
Yeah. Don't we need some physical evidence here now? You know, we all know how popular today TV is with forensic evidence, with CSI and Law and Order, in which they go through remarkable steps to prove who did the crime and how it was done. So we're talking about over 40 years ago, but surely even back then there had to be some evidence.
I mean, because even shows that were on at the time that were courtroom shows, I mean, you know, you watched an episode of Perry Mason and they offered you more evidence than that. And, you know, and you mentioned that show, The Defenders, that,
yeah,
you know, really made you feel like you were in the courtroom watching a court case unravel. And, you know, and you didn't see people on those shows in the jury boxes discussing the case with each other. I mean, they actually made an effort to have this courtroom look like a real courtroom. And it just puzzles me as to why they decided to turn Richard Kimball's case into such a, you know, such a caricature of a courtroom.
Well, I think that this goes further than that, because we've discussed before, and as Ken calls on the show today, he's going to bring up again how they should have done this in the pilot episode. They should have started with the crime, the escape, the trial, so forth and so on. I have no problem with that. You know, that would have been fine with me, but Linda always says she likes it the way it was. So you can take that either way.
Hey, can I ask something here about this?
Please.
Sure.
All right. When in the 60s, you know, you're looking at it from today's perspective, and the public in general is much better acquainted with what courtroom proceedings really looked like.
I was going to say that, I know.
Yeah, okay. So back then, was this not done in kind of a slipshod manner, and people really had no idea what reality to compare it with?
Well, all I can say is, I'm sure when I watched the show, I didn't worry about any of this. That's true. But just because we didn't notice it back then doesn't necessarily give them a pass on it. See, people will say, well, nobody cared back then whether or not it made any sense. But to me, I mean, if you're going to remember the show for four decades afterwards, if you're going to collect it on tape and you're going to wait for the DVD to come out, and you're going to say, as people often do, this is the best series ever, you have to pay off on that. So I can't sit here and say it's okay because, you know what, in the mid-60s we didn't care about it, because there was a lot of stuff going on in the mid-60s, a lot of political incorrectness compared to what's going on today. That doesn't make it right. That doesn't mean that it was the way to do it. I would agree to that extent. I'm sure nobody noticed it. In fact, I know nobody noticed it. I never thought about it until I created this group and we started looking in depth at everything. Back then, you just sat and watched a TV show. You didn't worry about any of that stuff because most people had never been in a courtroom anyway. So how do I know? Maybe it's normal for jurors to talk to each other. But, you know, we've all been through the O.J. Simpson case, so now we go, it's ridiculous.
But by the same token, there were other TV shows on, as we pointed out, with Perry Mason and The Defenders, and they didn't have jurors, you know, talking to each other on those shows, and they didn't have prosecuting attorneys rolling their eyes and making faces at jurors.
Well, no, but you also know on Perry Mason now that the accused could never have been guilty in the first place.
Well, yeah, so yes, but by this, you know, but I was just, you know, trying to cite it that at least when they were in the courtroom, they, you know, they seemed to make, they were seeming to try to make it seem like an actual courtroom. No, of course not. I mean, in reality, you don't get a guilty person on the stand who breaks down and confesses everything. I mean, that doesn't happen in real life. But at least in the courtroom proceeding itself, I mean, they were at least trying to make it look like an actual courtroom proceeding.
All right. Well, speaking of reality, we're going to face the reality of taking a about a two-minute timeout. When we return, Bobby and Kitty will speak to, surprise, Ken from Vista, California, who is patiently waiting here in the wings. We'll bring him on as soon as we return to talk Fugitive on Retro Radio.
There's a lot more to KSAV than just Tuesday night. From 6 a.m. through midnight, 7 days a week, it's Retro Radio. All the great music from the 40s,
unforgettable,
50s, and 60s. Blended with old commercials and station identifications from years gone by. Old-time radio programs such as Jack Benny, Burns and Allen, Dragnet, and many more make the nostalgia complete. Set your computer at work to KSAV and let everyone enjoy the music and the memories of a different era as KSAV plays all the music of your life, every day of your life.
All right, when we return to talk a little more Fugitive, I want to remind everybody, 7:30 Pacific time tonight, Talking Television with Dave White, my favorite show. The guest is going to be Herbie Pilato. Among his many accomplishments, he's the author of the book Bewitched Forever. And we'll talk about Bewitched, and he's written on Kung Fu and Kane and a whole bunch of stuff. So be with us tonight as well. If you want to talk here about Fugitive, 800-407-KSAV. And the person on that very phone line right now is Ken from Vista, California. Hi, Ken.
Hey, hi, Dave.
Hi. When I saw
your email on Bewitched, I said, that's an interesting show because that was one of my favorite shows also in the 60s.
Well, I hope you'll listen in tonight and call in and talk to Herbie Pilato. He was well acquainted with Elizabeth Montgomery and has a lot of firsthand information on that.
Besides Susan Oliver, I also had a crush on Elizabeth Montgomery.
You got her picture up there along with the Susan Oliver?
Absolutely.
Oh, God. Your wife must love it. Okay.
Oh, yeah. So, Ken, what's your question?
Well, you're talking about the trial. I remember the first time I saw the girl from Little Egypt, and they got into that little flashback on the trial. I said to myself, finally, you know, let's see what's going on. What happened? And that whole thing was ridiculous, and I got the feeling that the producers of the show really didn't want to get into that. They just rushed through it, gave us some hopscotch scenes. I thought the next-door neighbor, the woman, she was hilarious, you know, her testimony. And if I was the defense attorney, you know, I would have drilled her. I would have said, hey, didn't you see Kimball get into his car and screech out of the driveway and drive off? I watched that scene again. He gets into his car. He's seething mad. He backs out and screeches off. I would have asked the woman if she had seen that. And also I would have asked the woman, didn't you see the one-armed man run out of the house? Because he ran out of that house, kind of made a scene, and then Kimball almost ran him over and kind of screeched.
Yeah, it's so amazing how nobody seems to have seen Kimball leave or drive back in. And it's interesting that, you know, when you see this episode, it's episode 14. Well, we had had that episode a few episodes earlier, Nightmare at North Oak, where Wilma Springer asks him, was it a fair trial? And Kimball actually says yes. And after you see this, you're thinking, what is the matter with Kimball? This is his idea of a fair trial?
Yeah. What about the little boy? You know, Kimball said he saw the boy at the lake. I would have brought that up and maybe asked the boy, were you at the lake on that day?
Ken, that is in that scene. The prosecutor says to Kimball, he says, you claim that there was a boy fishing in the lake, and you've seen him, according to the prosecutor, he has been on the witness stand. And he says he never saw you. So I think they pretty much covered themselves on that. But that's a waste of time in this scene. It shouldn't even be brought up because there's nothing there. We already know that he didn't see him, so, you know, why discuss this? If the kid didn't see him, he didn't see him. Now, you guys are making my point here, which is that the problem with this entire trial, and I agree with you, Ken, as I said 2 weeks ago, they just don't want to do any of this. There is no sincerity here. You get the feeling that because those test audiences that they showed it to before it went on the air said they want the backstory, they did it to cover themselves in case it would have made a problem. But once they decided to do it, they said, listen, we're not going there. And I know why they didn't go there. It's not that they didn't want to do it. It's that they can't do it. They can't do a trial because there is no case against Richard Kimball. If you go back to the beginning, like we want them to do, and you start right there about the crime, and the detectives come to the house, and they look around, and they question everybody, and you see all of that, the one thing you're going to see is there's no case, so therefore there is no show. Once they had done that, it was too late. Actually, as much as I wish they would have, I understand why they didn't do it, because now it's too late. You know, Roy Huggins set up this series. This is a brilliant concept, but he did it very poorly because he obviously, to me, didn't want to get into that part. What he did was he set up the idea of this man roaming the country, not being able to stop anywhere. That's the basic of the whole story, and he didn't want to get into the rest of it. That's why at the beginning of the series, the narrator tells us the whole story. Listen, his wife got killed, and they think he did it, and he had to escape, and that's it. Don't ask me anything else. Don't ask me anything else. Now you get to the trial, and it's a mess because who's got the answer? If I was writing it, I would have thrown up my hands and said, don't expect me to write this scene because I don't know what the case is. There is no case. Kitty already said it. There's no, you know, he didn't have a mistress. There's no life insurance policy.
The funny thing is that, you know, at the beginning of the series, in the first episode, where Kimball is explaining to Monica what happened, he tells her that they were having an argument because he wanted to adopt a child and she didn't. Now, when we got to the trial scene, who's to say that we couldn't have brought other things up? You know, bring up a life insurance policy, you know, add the hint of impropriety on Kimball's part, even though there wasn't. You know, who's to say somebody couldn't say, well, but they saw you and this other person together? They certainly could have added things like that, or, you know, and like I said, the insurance policy, you know, because you could always go with the idea that Kimball left those details out because he didn't want Monica to think he really did kill his wife.
Right. Let me ask Ken something before we run out of time. Ken, what about the 83 one-armed men thing? What'd you think about that?
I thought the Gerard flashback with him on the trial, I was really hoping for more. And when he just talked about that, that was kind of laughable also. You know, Gerard, and did you see the expression on Gerard's face? He was kind of mellow and kind of soft.
You mean when he's on the stand or when the judge pronounces sentence?
No, when he's on the stand, and also, you're right, when he's in the audience there listening to the judge, he was kind of just mellow. He kind of has a little, I don't know what kind of look on his face. It was odd to me. But,
well, that scene,
one thing I wanted to,
you
know, what you said about the show. The one question I would have asked Quinn Martin, you know, the executive producer,
yeah.
I would have said, was your main point with Kimball was to make him a hero and a white knight throughout the whole series? Or did you have another angle? Because I tell you what, if I was the producer, like I said, I would have had the pilot properly. I would have answered some questions for the audience. Then I would have got into a lot of storylines. And then, you know, go from there. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you, and I think it should have been done that way. But it's impossible to know what was in his head. I don't know. I think he was caught up in the basic concept of having a man accused of a crime but still be heroic anyway.
Yeah.
You know, he's like an anti-hero. He's just, you know, he's the most unusual person because normally you either hate somebody or you like him. In this case, he's accused of something horrible, but on the other hand, we see him how wonderful he is, so we're going, well, could he have really done it? Could he have done it? And I think he just got caught up in that, and he wasn't really interested in the backstory and getting into the trial and all. That's why it starts the way it does. But it's, you know, it does not make me happy. It's still a great series,
yeah.
But I think they really missed something there. On that final scene there where Gerard is in the audience and the judge pronounces the sentence, and Kimball says, "Before God, I did not kill my wife." Gerard looks down at the floor a little bit. Everybody makes a big business over this. And Robertson even mentions it in his book, that perhaps Gerard is having a little remorse here, that he's wondering whether he really did it. I don't see it that way. Maybe it's just me. I think Gerard's just looking down at the floor because Kimball is once again claiming he didn't do it. The same thing he does in Nightmare North, though, when he says that through the prison bars. Gerard always has a reaction to that, but I don't think it indicates that he changed his mind. Do you really believe that he's having some second thoughts there?
No, not at all.
Okay. Kidding?
I think he just has a very odd look on his face. We really don't know where Gerard's coming from the beginning of the series, in the middle. It's only toward the end that we start to see Gerard, really.
Kitty, do you think he had any remorse?
But you know, another question I would ask? How could 12 jurors come to the conclusion that Kimball is guilty and worthy of the death penalty? That was amazing, too. Could you get 12 people to convict Kimball there? That was amazing.
Well, keep in mind that in some states, it isn't, I don't think it's this way anymore, but at one time, and I think at that time, a judge did have the ability to decide himself if somebody should be sent to death. It didn't necessarily have to be the jurors that decided that.
Yeah, but how about second-degree murder? Would that be first degree?
No, death penalty is only for first degree.
That's what
I'm
saying. So,
yeah.
You know, he not only gets accused of murder, he gets first-degree murder.
Yeah, precisely. And, you know, and as for Gerard having remorse, I don't think he necessarily has remorse, but I sometimes think maybe he kind of wonders if, you know, I've always thought that he's got this voice in the back of his head that's wondering if Kimball really is innocent. But such an ego that he won't allow himself to really explore it.
We'll have to answer that in 2 weeks when you return. Ken, thanks a lot for calling as usual. Next week at 6 o'clock Pacific Time, Getting to Know You with Susan McCrae will fill the time spot. 2 weeks, Kitty and Bobby will be back to talk some more Fugitive.
Can I tell what our next topic is?
Go quickly.
Women of the Fugitive, Season 1, Part 1.
All right, and that'll include Ken's girlfriend up there on the wall. So be with us. It's in 2 weeks. Stay tuned for Perfectly Frank, Talk and Television with Dave White at 7:30. Thanks for listening, everybody, to Retro Radio.